This one-up podcast is brought to you by the Laptop Experts, makers of the Toshiba Satellite X205, a laptop with enough power to destroy a small planet. Visit www.toshiba.com/expert.
Jerk for the 9.5, make a living, barely get by, no taking, all giving, pretend that you're blind, and that you never said it, enough to drive you crazy if you let it. Jerk for the 9.5, make a living, barely get by, no taking, all giving, pretend that you're blind, and that you never said it, enough to drive you crazy if you let it. Oh, for shame, I'm not as choosy as you. The game's name is professional enthusiasm. Cheers to lead, sheeple to bleed, mouths to feed, trouble I don't need. Honestly, honesty's not the best policy. Advertising, access the rest if you follow me. 9.5 is a great way to go. I hate to say 10, ethics, you know. Nor will a 9 work, that's too low. But if you want business, you never say no. You suck and you blow, that's my maxim. The internet agrees, you'll see, go and ask them. Every game's a masterpiece, make them faster, please. I promise to pay attention until the next release. God only knows, that takes expertise. The number game's not worth another wage. Jerk for the 9.5, make a living, barely get by, no taking, all giving, pretend that you're blind, and that you never said it, enough to drive you crazy if you let it. Jerk for the 9.5, make a living, barely get by, no taking, all giving, pretend that you're blind, and that you never said it, enough to drive you crazy if you let it.
What's the difference between
10 and a 9.5?
Like 30 to 40 grand, cocksucker, beat it.
Hello and welcome to GFW Radio. This is the podcast for December 4th, 2007. We are going to be rushing through this one, sadly, unfortunately, because we're on one of those god-awful, horrible schedules where like 800 people need the room. So apologies in advance. Fortunately, there's nothing to talk about this week since really nothing happened, right? nothing at all. It's business as usual here in the games industry. This is Jeff Green, and I'm here with the other gang, rest of the gang from GFW, which includes
Ryan Scott,
Sean Malloy,
and Sean Elliott.
And Darren Gladstone is, in fact, alive and well. He's very, very busy with lots of tech stuff these days, but he is alive, and he says hi. So we're all kind of living in a sort of a post-Gerstmann world now. And I'm not sure where to begin on that thing or even how we want to approach it because we don't prepare for this podcast.
Take mental notes.
But I do want to say, first of all, we are going to talk about this issue because really it's hard to not talk about this issue. But I am going to issue the standard disclaimer, which is very necessary, that we don't know anything more here about what went down with GameSpot's firing of Jeff Gerstmann other than what all of you listening know from various news stories and blogs and forum messages, all of which involve a lot of speculation. So some of what we're talking about is just us being kind of righteous blowhards without any real information, but that doesn't mean we can't be righteous blowhards, because goddammit, that's our right.
Springboard to talk about the industry.
It definitely,
and the way that things work, the way that we interface with publishers and developers and
right.
Our editorial teams and our marketing teams and all these things. And by talking around it and sort of about, you know, that and the state of the industry, I think it does make sense, and it will show, and I believe, you know, once we do talk about it, it'll show you to some extent why it's plausible to take the speculation and to connect the dots in the way that people are connecting them.
Right.
Why it's a possible move for people to make, not why it's possible that this is actually the you know, I'm tripping over myself.
I know what you
basically
mean. We know what you mean.
These that dots it's not very conceivable, and that the thought isn't necessarily, it's not just insane conspiracy theory.
The fact that it is very, very believable in of itself is very telling and sad. The fact that a story like this could come out And we all are sort of assuming it's probably true, or aspects of it are true. This should never be the case in journalism. This should just this rumor shouldn't even have happened. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that it did is why the story is so big and why it's not going away for a lot of us. I mean, I'm sure CNET and GameSpot and IDOS are all hoping it just goes away now. But I think for a lot of us, it's not really going to, because it raises some huge, huge questions. If you're listening and you don't know what happened, the things we do know are that Jeff Gerstmann, who's the editorial director, I think was his title at GameSpot, he'd been there for 11 years, and he was fired from GameSpot. And from what I understand, from the stories we've read anyway, he was summarily fired, meaning he showed up at work and found out he was fired. Right?
Exactly.
This is what we know. We also know that around the same time, GameSpot had a massive advertising campaign going on their website, on the front door of their site, for the game Kane and Lynch from IDOS. And we also know that Gerstmann had written a largely unfavorable review and had filmed a video review of the same game. Both were fairly negative.
And then the video review was taken down without
right.
explanation.
So all in the same sequence of events, Mr. Gerstmann lost his job. The video review was pulled down. The print review received some edits.
And then staff
shortly thereafter,
blogging.
The ads got removed from GameSpot. Right. And then we started seeing some blog posts from the GameSpot editors themselves referring to the incident, and a couple websites. Kotaku and Joystick started picking up some comments, and ValleyWag, a Silicon Valley kind of gossip site, started getting anonymous info about what had gone down there that day at GameSpot.
From someone purporting to be a GameSpot employee.
Right. So, you know, one thing is that all of us here know, all of us in this room, that the game publishers aren't happy when they get negative reviews. This happens all the time. They will get cranky to the point of like calling our bosses and saying, we're going to pull our ads if you don't, you know, if since you don't like our games, apparently we don't need to advertise with you. This happens all the time. And again, you know, we can't prove it. We don't know what really happened.
This is what I was saying, why it's not entirely unrealistic, is that we know that publishers exercise a great deal of pressure on, you know, writers for magazines and websites, and that there are all these pressures to give games high scores. So they might be they'll be indirect. I mean, there's that, where in most cases people on the editorial side of the firewall shouldn't hear about this, right? I mean, they will go to the advertising departments. But every time we talk about it and we say we know it exists, like I've heard other people say, oh, we know it exists, but it's never happened to us. It's like, well, I don't believe that, because you got to know it exists somehow.
Right.
Once in a while, a whisper will slip through the firewall and you'll be made aware of the fact that, oh, someone's punishing us. You know?
Actually, that's true. I can definitely tell you that there's times where it will filter down to me, say, as editor-in-chief of this magazine, that some advertiser got annoyed about something we wrote in the magazine, and it like went down the chain and it gets to me. But then even getting to me is unusual.
Right.
But when it gets to me, like, I won't often tell one of you, because it's just an unfair pressure to
we
have to face.
You shouldn't
ever have to think about that.
And I mean, I think that's, you know, I want to hit this up later, but I think a lot of times if you look very closely at reviews and stuff, I will, you know, at least in my mind, I will think that I see people writing for publishers to some extent, or writing with an awareness of the publisher rather than writing just for their audience. You know, they'll do certain things that I think are indicative of that. But, so in addition to that side, we have, I mean, and there, well, let's talk about, for a possible solution there in the dream world is for magazines and websites to have what are known as non-endemic ads.
Right.
And that means that they're not advertisements for the products that we cover in our editorial.
Right.
So in other words, Mountain Dew, we don't write about Mountain Dew, you know, that's fine. Mountain Dew is not going to get pissed off and say they're not going to support us because we said that their new latest drink at Taco Bell tastes like crap.
Right. Yeah, this is totally my dream scenario, that the game press, that the gaming media all across the board for all of us that we can get away from being reliant on the very people we write about to support us with advertising. You know, it doesn't happen in any other media right now. And it's one of the reasons why, quote unquote, games journalism is in such an infantile state. You know, like I was saying before we went on the air, you know, it's as if TV shows were, you know, had product placement that was then, you know, that was not product placement. Like, let's say you're watching According to Jim, and Jim Belushi says, like, man, this Diet Pepsi tastes like urine. And the guys who make Diet Pepsi who bought an ad are going, well, what the fuck? Right. Fuck you. Why is Jim Belushi saying Diet Pepsi tastes like piss?
And in some cases,
we're pulling our ads. Fuck you.
Because the review will appear on the very same, you know, opposite page of an advertisement. It would be like Belushi saying that and then it cutting immediately to a commercial break and then it being Diet Pepsi.
Right. So Pepsi can just take their, you know, their urine flavored drink and go home. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what we need here is a magazine and a website like GameSpot, or I think full of like automobile ads and soda ads and potato chip ads,
you can make fun of McGriddles,
where you can write a 6 out of 10 review and not get fired for it.
Yeah, exactly. People laughed at that McGriddles thing, but that is the route to honesty.
Seriously, don't look the McGriddle in the mouth.
Yeah.
And that would go a long way to solving that part of the problem. I don't believe that is the solution, though, because the difference is if, say, the show, you know, say, what is this? I've never watched it. According to Jim, is that what you called it?
Yeah, I haven't watched it either.
Sure, you never watched
so
it.
So say, what
except
if,
for the first five
in order
seasons.
To write the scripts for According to Jim, they needed the help of Pepsi Company. Mm-hmm. And this is the circumstances that we're in, you know, because say if we even want to write something that's not a preview or that's not a review, you know, we can write reviews free of their assistance. We can go to the store and buy them.
Sure.
There's another pressure there, and that's to be timely. And to be timely and to be sooner, you have to get the code in advance from the developer and the publisher. If they're pissed off at you, they're not going to want to give it to you in advance. If you're going to write let's go beyond the preview and say, we're going to do a story like now, you know, in our next issue, we're looking at, you know, all these reasons why games are delayed, some classic cases of games that have been delayed. And so if we want to talk about, you know, these case studies, you know, what happens? Paint a broad picture by talking to all these individuals and seeing what in particular went wrong or what happened, what stalled their development process. Well, if one of those companies that made one of those games is upset with you because you gave a score that they weren't happy with to one of their games, or the publisher, maybe the developer just fine, like whatever, but the publisher's not happy, you will not have access to those people.
Right.
So again, that's limiting your information. And almost every story that you could possibly write for one of these, you know, for one of our sites or magazines, at some point is going to need some source or some sort of contact. And
well, that's
a
totally separate issue.
Practice,
from,
though, yes,
from the advertising anyway.
It's another issue, yes. But I just want to look at, like, to make it, in the broad sense, all these pressures for doing positive things. But so that is still a pressure. If you know, if we give this game this score, the score that we truly believe it deserves, we know that we risk not getting information, we not getting the next cover story based on the game that developer makes, another game by the same publisher, any follow-up stuff, any, you know, afterthought sorts of interviews, stories like the kind I'm talking about, so all these are there too.
One would think that our chances of getting the Hellgate London 2 cover story are probably severely diminished at this point.
I would say they're probably slim to none. And of course, it's not the publisher's, you know, it's not our right to demand any of this information.
Of course.
That's the thing. This is all private, you know, I mean, they're making entertainment to sell it. These are businesses. They don't owe anyone anything. They don't need to let you go to their events. They don't need to give you screenshots, and you need to speak to the people who make the games. Mm-hmm. And they do it because it's in their interest to get the word out. But if the word that you're getting out is negative, or if they think that when the review comes, it's going to be negative, then they can pull it. And so that's the thing that makes me wonder. I mean, is it even to the extent where we need to separate magazines and sites that do editorial stuff from those that do reviews? Do you have to like keep the two apart in general? Because it's always on the reviews where you get slammed.
Right. But if you keep those things separate, then we are just a wing of their PR department.
Not necessarily, though. You can write critical previews. I'm a firm believer in that. And all the, you know, the sorts of stories that I'm talking about.
But the critical preview, if it's critical, is going to have the same negative impact.
That's true.
You know?
But so the other story, what if it was entirely feature-based?
Right.
And it was all thematic. Like, say, you know, you're looking at various trends in 2007 right. game making and all these things, and you do need to talk to the developers, or you want right. to look at how a studio functions and how it works, you know?
Right.
How it differs from others.
I mean, those I totally hear what you're saying.
Say what?
There are places that do that.
Like yeah, there's like Gamasutra yeah. and stuff right. like that, you know?
Right, that's true. Yeah. But, I mean, look at something even like Entertainment Weekly. I mean, this is a magazine that comes out every week, and they have totally insidery, suck-up-y interviews with people, and they have glowing previews or whatever. But then in the same issue, they'll give Fs to major movies or Ds
right.
or to major CDs. You know, so obviously in that case, the machinery is in place where they are able to take these very critical stances and still operate with or work with the same companies to get insider information. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, what's the difference there? How come it
I don't
works
know
there?
If maybe, I mean, maybe we're not aware of, maybe there are cases where there's grudge holding and stuff and there are covers that get changed in the last minute because
yeah.
one company is more eager to work with you than another. Or maybe sometimes there is a bit of a fallout
yeah.
when that cover story runs in the same issue as a negative review.
Right.
I mean,
mm-hmm. I mean, it also probably is that, you know, Entertainment Weekly is owned by, what is it, a Time Warner? So really, the advertising is happening way, way, way up the food chain,
right? And right. it is yeah. non-endemic. I mean, there's, mm-hmm. I mean, there that is there. I mean, that's the point you're making is that's a huge help. And I think that I agree. That's an absolutely important, you know, place to get to. But I just don't think it solves everything. I think you have
right.
to deal with
right.
that pressure. And I think this is why I like to talk about it, is that I never hear publicly anyone acknowledging these things. You know. Watch your mic. You're rubbing your beard.
I'm rubbing my beard, and it's making sorry.
And it's like just pretending they don't exist doesn't make it not true. You know, I mean, immediately you see so many people's reactions from other outlets. Well, we never do this. I can guarantee you that nothing like this ever happens here. And that's to simplify the thing. It's like, well,
yes,
of course,
it
hasn't happened, and we can all say yes. No one's ever told us that we need to say to be kinder or to raise uh-huh. our scores. But we also are all aware of the way the business works and the pressures. And we do know the good things that come with kissing ass.
Mm-hmm.
And when you write reviews in such a way that you're basically trying to sell a product, when you're writing it like a sales pitch, there's good things that come of that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's other things too. I mean, there's so many different lines that you can cross that cause problems. And everyone's aware of that. They're full of shit if they say otherwise. So if we had an exclusive review on our cover and we were to say, wow, this isn't that good. We're not going to give it a good game. Someone in that department would say, we better give this publisher a heads up.
Yes.
Because this is going to seriously strain our relationship. Or if you just do it, then that would be it. You would do it and they would be pissed off and you'd face all the repercussions that we've just outlined, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's there. And that means that is still a subtle pressure. So if you're the person reviewing the game and you know it's the cover story and it's the exclusive review, and you know, in addition to that it's supposed to be the big sell for your magazine. It's mm-hmm. supposed to, you know, that there's even, since more eyes are going to be on it and it's going to be the only representative of scores on Metacritic for some period of time, mm-hmm. that pressure is there.
Well, this is the big reason why we stopped doing exclusive reviews a while ago, to avoid this issue entirely, this specific issue of exclusive reviews. We stopped doing them in this magazine because we didn't want to have to deal with that idea.
Right. Anything you can do to just reduce that pressure. I mean, so yeah, it's like, well, instead of burning all these bridges because we know we wouldn't, you know, we would basically call it like we see it. And we were also aware that potentially means burning bridges with a lot of people over these high stake things.
Yeah.
The high stakes of it, I think also, it's kind of like reaching this hysteria and this fever pitch this year. In all the years I've been in the business, you've mm-hmm. got much more experience, so you can compare it to
true.
Your
this
experience.
Is...
But it seems like this year is almost is worse than ever.
And this Gerstmann thing, this is, to me, this was inevitable. Something like this, like it's been building. This this bullshit pressure that, that the publishers will put on the media because they have so much power over people in charge at the media outlets, financial power, monetary power, that eventually somebody was going to buckle.
The firewall was going to break.
Somebody was going to do it, and it appears to have happened here. Maybe it didn't. Maybe we don't know
enough.
We
have no idea.
We don't know.
But that's yet another reason why we're not dismissing it immediately, why we're at least entertaining the thought along with everyone else.
Right. And, you know, I mean, look, it took CNET, what, like a week here or a few days to come up with a kind of public announcement. First of all, the fact that they had to make a public announcement, you know, who has to write a public press release about a employee? When has this ever happened in the games media, that a press release comes out because an editor got fired?
Right.
I mean,
right.
Clearly there's a something fishy about this that they're acknowledging. But I mean, of course, their press release says there was nothing fishy about it, that in fact, actually, I have it in front of me.
Why don't you read that, Joe?
I'll read this. This is on the front page of GameSpot. The headline is Gerstmann GameSpot Part Ways. That's the headline. The deck is, after nearly 11 years of news, reviews, and previews, editorial director's tenure ends. GameSpot editors address controversy surrounding his departure. Okay, that was the long-winded deck. Here's the article. The past week marked the end of an era at GameSpot. After over a decade in a variety of editorial roles, Jeff Gerstmann's tenure as editorial director has ended. It just ended. You know,
right.
It has ended.
There are
nice,
you know, to be fair
there.
Though, when you terminate an employee,
well, of course,
you're not able to go,
yeah,
make
that's
a
right.
public statement as to why, no. And then the employees,
right?
Often
they were going to say Jeff Gerstmann's tenure as editor has ended because we fired his ass,
right?
You know,
or who
part.
Knows what it can be? Not him,
it
but take someone else. Say there was, you know, at company X, there someone was fired for sexual harassment or something like that. You're not going to go out and say. And I'm not. I don't mean to imply that this is the case with him whatsoever.
Right.
But by way of analogy, to show that it's one of the reasons why you don't disclose the reasons that you fire people.
Of course.
And I mean, there's so many. There's so much potential for lawsuits and going back and forth. So I'm just saying to keep it in mind. I mean, they aren't going to be able to say that much.
Of course they can't. And this is why Jeff can't either. You know, neither parties can, which is why we're really going to never, honestly, really never know exactly what happened here.
Right. And you wouldn't even know, like, say if, you know, he signed, along with the severance package, he signed an agreement to not talk for X number of years.
Right.
Even after those years pass and then he does talk about it, then that's still one side of the story.
Yep. Right. In fact, they say, I'm skipping a little bit here, but due to legal constraints and the company policy of GameSpot parent CNET Networks, details of Gerstmann's departure cannot be disclosed publicly. However, contrary to widespread and unproven reports, his exit was not a result of pressure from an advertiser. And then they quote, neither CNET Networks nor GameSpot has ever allowed its advertising business to affect its editorial content, said Greg Brannon, CNET Networks Entertainment's Vice President of Programming. Quote, the accusations in the media that it has done so are unsubstantiated and untrue. Jeff's departure stemmed from internal reasons unrelated to any buyer of advertising on GameSpot. Though he will be missed by his colleagues, Jeff's leaving does not affect GameSpot's core mission of delivering the most timely news, video content, in-depth previews, and unbiased reviews in games journalism, said Ryan McDonald, executive editor of GameSpot Live. GameSpot is an institution, and its code of ethics and duty to its users remains unchanged. Okay, so that's their official statement. You know, without any real evidence or quotes or anything to the contrary, all you can do is take it at face value.
And, well, you do look – I mean, the dots are at least worth examining, and some of those, as you know, we pointed out, are when it seems like everyone who works for the company is uniformly distraught and being really, really weird and awkward about it, you know, and understandably so, you know, by which I mean to blog and then 5 minutes later edit that down and apologize. And,
well, let's take it from our own perspective. Like, imagine, you know well, I guess you could take me, right? I would kind of be Jeff's parallel. He was at GameSpot for 11 years, and I've been here for about 11 years. Mm-hmm. So imagine you come in one day, and I've been fired. A review I had written was pulled. a video review I had done was pulled, and now you're supposed to carry on. I mean, what's going through your heads?
Right.
I mean, I can't imagine. Well, maybe part of it is like, thank God that moron's gone. But, you know, maybe the rest of it is, you know, well, geez, what am I supposed to write now? What happens the next time I write a negative review?
That you would talk to us, too.
Right.
And then
all of a sudden, I'm just gone.
And then I would assume that you would talk to us. And then at that point, we'd say, well, we've worked with you for however many years. We feel like we know you and we can trust you. And that it's not, you know, then we can judge whether or not we feel you're giving us some bullshit story and you really did get fired for stealing or something else ridiculous. And now you're making this whole thing up.
Right. Maybe I was like taking a dump in the urinal.
And you wouldn't want to admit that.
No. Right. Of course, I'd rather probably just say that I lowballed a review rather than admit that. So, and that was not, in fact, my dump in the urinal last week.
I wanted to go back to the to the sort of hysteria that's happening this year. The most sense I can make from that is that the stakes are now so high to successfully make and market a game that Ryan's laughing. Sorry, I'm trying to change the tone
serious.
From the dumps in the urinals. No, but so it costs an extraordinary amount of money to make what we call a AAA game, right? Mm-hmm. And the market is tighter than ever. I mean, you see these big games that you know, were developers and publishers have clearly spent millions making them and marketing them, and then they fail. And that's like a huge wager to make. And not many companies can withstand failing, you know, losing those bets indefinitely. And so they want to do everything in their power to hedge that bet. Mm-hmm. And scores is one way to do it. And that's also tied into Metacritic. And that, I think, is another, in addition to the high stakes nature of things now, mm-hmm. is also the way that aggregate scoring sites, the role that those sites play.
Right.
Because it's, even if in the past, before those sites existed, you had whatever, EGM, say, gives a game a 6 that a lot of other sites gave a 7.5 or an 8, you know. It's just, well, that's fine. That's an EGM thing. But now when the employees of these companies are getting bonuses based on the Metacritic score, and that's factoring into whether or not they immediately greenlight a sequel even before they have sales figures, you know, then it's more, well, what is your 6 doing to the average? Mm-hmm. What is it? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's influencing it. And so when you can just look at the whole thing, it's like, well, what are you doing for our Metacritic's thing? And I hear this like time and time again from people that work in development and PR and everything, is that they live and die by that average.
Some of them, well, we've talked about this in the podcast before, right? This is that's the phone call we always get.
Right.
How come it was 7 on, or 8 on Metacritic and you guys gave it a 5? You know, well, because we thought differently about the game.
It could even just be, you know, they're not weighting our numbers properly. Mm-hmm. You know, there's
well,
the whole
there's that too.
Thing where the averages aren't necessarily
it
weighted.
Is different. And when we say a 5 is an average, we try to enforce that. And this is like, say, for example, if you look at the GameSpot Kanal interview and the video review that's been pulled, when I listen to those and when I read that, mm-hmm. I don't see a 6 at all. I see like a 4, you know, mm-hmm. or maybe somewhere between 3.5 and 4.5 or whatever. And I don't see the 6 at all. I'm like, oh, he's describing an unfun game mm-hmm. through and through. And talking about some potential it might have had but didn't deliver on. But mm-hmm. that, in my mind, and then saying, hey, that's an above-average score. That mm-hmm. doesn't add up. So, well, yeah, I mean, like, that's a difference in between. That's indicative of the fact that, you know, in our, you know, rubric, a 5 is the average.
I do actually find it ironic that of all things for this to blow up over, it is a game like this where, you know, which by all accounts is fairly mediocre. And, in fact, his 6 isn't that far out of line even from the Metacritic's. I mean, this isn't like...
I don't think it's out of line at all, no.
A game that was getting 9.5s or something that this guy had, mm-hmm. you know, such a wildly different opinion from everybody else.
Right.
Not that the things are related at all. We know that his review and his leaving were not, in fact, related, according to CNET. Let's clarify that. They've cleared the air now, so... Lest I be accused of throwing stones. I'm not.
Yeah, we've explained that. I mean, so a few earlier I was saying how sometimes it seems to me like a writer of a review is writing for a publisher.
Sure.
A little bit. And one bit of evidence for that. I don't think it might be deliberate. I don't think it's ever conscious where someone says, oh, I got to make sure that this is just okay for the publisher. But again, it's like when I talk about these pressures, they're indirect, but they're there in the back of your mind. And I think they influence the way you go about things. So there's this phenomenon in game reviews, and I don't quite have a name for it. Maybe someone can help me coin one, but it's basically a flip-flop, you know, or it's just, it's kind of like letting something critical slip through and then immediately backtracking and apologizing it away.
Uh-huh.
It's like, I didn't really mean to say a negative thing. The closest, this is a,
well,
really,
it's a bit of a straw man, right? I mean, it's a
harebrained analogy I got is that chimpanzees have been documented to, you know, it's going somewhere. Well, they basically,
oh,
show their
chimp
teeth.
Story?
They bare their teeth when they're frightened, right? But some chimps have also been observed hiding, covering their mouth after they've shown it, because in a dominance hierarchy, say you're one of the more dominant figures and you've inadvertently shown, revealed that you're afraid of someone that's subordinate to you, you want to cover that up. You don't want to hide it.
Right.
They've also covered their, not to take it back to sex, but they'll cover their genitals and stuff if they have an erection and they're seen by a female that is actually not supposed to be in his access, you know? So it's kind of like that. I just feel like you read these things and it's like, hey, you just got caught baring your teeth. You better cover that shit up now.
Right.
Before someone notices and calls out the fact that you were actually doing something you weren't supposed to be doing. And that's actually being a critic, being critical. So an example would be this from a major source. It says, the pretty facelift and refined game mechanics are great, but they can only mask the fact that SmackDown 07 is still a frustrating button masher. And then the very next sentence is, that's not to say it isn't an enjoyable experience, however. SmackDown 07 is an undeniably good-looking game. So, I mean, like in there you have, I mean, a frustrating button masher, and then suddenly it's enjoyable. I mean, well, what is it? You know, I mean, and not saying everyone does it, but it's fairly common. I think if you start looking, you'll see it over and over again. I mean, to be fair, it's everywhere. I just saw, I'm sure it's in our own magazine. I saw something went up on 1UP today where, I mean, it was immediately, it said, you know, unfortunately, the game lacked tangible feedback when we shot an opponent, and occasionally repeated fire would seem to do nothing but bounce off enemy armor. And then the next sentence again is, however, the graphics looked polished. The map layouts were strong and the grenades were a blast to use. So,
well, some of this is just probably writing ability and structure. I mean, it's completely like any product in any piece of art or literature, whatever, has its pros and cons, right? I mean, so being able to say like this one part of the game is great and this other part of the game sucks, it's not, there's nothing wrong with that,
right?
Of course, it's sort of like juxtaposing these,
it's
within
the fact
two
that
sentences.
They're always juxtaposed, and
right,
it's always in that order too. Where
good,
some good comes around immediately after the bad to try to undo it,
right? Right.
To show you, you know.
But to be fair,
okay,
that could just be a result of this established, like, this is how game reviews go structure.
It could be that too, where you just see. Yeah, exactly. You
this,
look at,
but this, this, yeah, but this,
there are
this,
all these,
but this, conclusion.
Right. There are all these templates to writing reviews.
Exactly. Let's send that out to our staff.
Please follow this format.
And then, like, my one complaint is, you know, you see so many, there's always this, like, one sentence that says, my one complaint, if it's all good, and that's to show you, well, I'm not totally retarded.
Here's another one. Right?
I've got one critical muscle.
And then another one. Usually there's many, many concluding paragraphs that start, niggles aside.
Yes, that's the same version of, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, niggles aside. That's really, I mean, yeah, I believe that's true, exactly what you're saying, Sean. Because, you know, what happens is you have reviews, and especially with websites and stuff, you have to get these things out fast.
But yeah, I was about
the longer it takes you to get it out, the less people are going to care about reading it.
Right.
And the more, there's so many games coming out, and you've got to crank it out. And the only way to do that is to rely on these structures, on these boilerplates. And unfortunately, the boilerplates are largely bullshit, you know, and that's like, you gave an example of one. And if you've been doing it for a while, you'll recognize all the boilerplates and be like, oh, he used boilerplate C.
Yep.
And you just fit in the game names, you know. The problem with that, of course, though, is, I mean, if you want useful reviews, is that you're not, it's not just that you're looking at templated writing, but I think that the templates structure the thinking, you know, so you're not actually, it's actually the lack of insight and engagement with the game and just filling it in. And you have these really weird scenarios, you know. Maybe I could talk later today about Soldier of Fortune Payback, which I just reviewed. And browsing around, you'll see people commenting on, you know, in one paragraph they'll comment on, you know, blowing people's faces off and this and that. And then the very next one, they'll say how the music's catchy. Right. To a normal person, that seems, you know, like a sign of sociopathy, right? I mean, very much it does. I mean, you know, if someone's in a room and they're talking about, you know, blowing these dudes away, and it's very lifelike, and they drag their bloody stumps across the ground, and the music's pretty catchy. I mean, you'd say, well, this is a sociopath that I'm dealing with, you know?
Yeah.
But it's just a sign of the template there, but I think it's both. It's the template is making it a bad review, and the template's also preventing someone from thinking or from even understanding what they're saying.
Yeah.
So it's like, hey, I have to have the audio paragraph that comes after the control paragraph. Mm-hmm. And then you have those things that make you look like a sociopath because you really aren't thinking about what it is you're saying, you know?
Right.
to get that one out there.
I like that one.
Right. You know, not to toot my own horn here, but that Greenspeak I wrote a while ago, that the Cudgel of Xanthor story, you know, that
people still think is a legitimate.
Well, that's why I'm bringing it up because what I did there was I took this cliche that we're talking about, this format. I did the graphics paragraph, the water effects paragraph, the sound paragraph.
And you did it with like a hands-on preview.
I did. I said it wasn't a review. It was a hands-on preview. But in fact, there was nothing existed in this game. I mean, first of all, I made it up in my head. But the point was that the company itself had nothing to show me. There wasn't a game. But I still wrote about all those things. And I kept saying how great it all was.
And it was so clearly parody to us.
Right. And yet I still will get emails from people saying like, that game sounds really good. And like, how could it sound good? I didn't say anything.
There's a big shed on the big shed on Game Thread. No, on Game Shack.
Game Shack.
And oh, right. People arguing about, well, listen to this fucking hypocrite. You ever listen to GFW Radio?
Oh, yeah. The people who didn't get that. Yeah.
Talking about writing. Well, look at this.
Right.
And then, like, even an employee,
awesome.
Jumps in the thread and is like, oh, God, did a freelancer do this?
Yeah.
And I was like,
Jeff
wow.
Green's really lost it.
You were a little too subtle, I guess, even though I thought it was beating us.
I thought it was way over the top.
I thought it was way over the top.
Yeah,
you
same
know?
Here.
But what that told me was that, like, that, you know, the people will just read that, you know, if you operate within that template, you know, you can make literally anything sound great.
Right.
I made nothing, absolutely nothing, be a game that people wanted to play.
I can't wait for this game.
this is still tied into too, and I think that previews, I have a problem with non-evaluative hands-on previews, especially when we're talking, you know, in the months immediately prior to the game's release, where you know that for the most part they're working eliminating bugs, mm-hmm. and that's it. But mm-hmm. the game that you're playing is the game that's going to be in people's hands,
right?
Give or take some of the bugs, and you know, a lot. It's been this big debate, and it kind of, you know, EGM went through it with their Too Human hands-on story,
right?
At E3. And it's odd to me to still see people, you know, there's this one guy, some guy was blogging about how he was calling it a review, that they misleadingly reviewed this game that wasn't done, mm-hmm. which was really insane. I mean, not because they're in the same building and because I used to work there, but because, I mean, rationally, it was packaged in a previews feature. And when you start off, it says that this is a previews feature and that this, you know, we're at this annual games convention where we're able to play these games. And what we're going to do is sort of evaluate our experience mm-hmm. with these games. Mm-hmm. It's not, we're not going to give it scores that are consistent with the scoring system we use for our review section. That's later in the book. You'll see that there and you'll see how different it is from this, you know, mm-hmm. I'm just going to comment on these. And the reason being is to make it worth your while, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's no one that goes to these things and plays these games and doesn't form some opinion. And also the beginning of that article pointed out that like, hey, these opinions can change. Just as the games can change, yep. and they'll change along with the game. So all that in place,
right.
Someone was freaking out about that, and a lot of people were freaking out about
it. But Sean, but it's hard for some people to understand the difference between a review and a preview, kind of like Eidos showed on their website.
There you go.
Just today, wasn't it?
It was.
Was it just
when I saw the story, at least?
Yeah, I think it's gone now, but it was pointed out on Kotaku, and you can find it on NeoGAF, so you can find images of what happened. That these guys just they really want some good Caden Lynch reviews, I think, at IDOS. they're going to some extremes. So
there's no way it could have been an accident. Well, of course, there were quotes taken from previews of games, and they were accompanied with 5 stars.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they were taken from some sites that used stars, like GameSpy, and others
right.
that didn't.
And GameSpy, in fact, had reviewed the game and given it 3 stars. However, Eidos very cleverly chose to quote from a preview that GameSpy wrote before the game came out, which was a glowing preview sentence. And above that glowing sentence from the preview, they had a 5-star... Yeah. They had a 5-star logo above it.
Right.
My guess is someone over there, this is total speculation, just like convinced themselves that it's just a design element and it's okay.
Right. We're not saying
it's just, that, quote, a design element.
Right. These 5 stars actually aren't linked to these quotes.
That's crazy.
It's We're just separating these quotes by this clever, this cute little 5-star visual.
Yeah, I don't even buy that. There's like, it's such a deliberate attempt to mislead. Even if you say,
of course
even
it
if you're
of course
like, it oh, it's a yeah. design element, that's basically packaging your alibi with the crime at the time that you commit the
yeah.
crime.
Yeah, right. It is pure.
That's what I meant by he convinced himself.
Yeah,
okay.
Right. Exactly. And in fact, it's pure fucking bullshit. They shouldn't have done it. They got called on it. And in fact, now it's gone.
It does.
As if to show that they knew it was wrong. And
it does highlight the disparity between the content of previews and reviews very nicely, though. Because when you look at the comments, you're like, huh. And then, like, you know, and then you're like, hey, well, then there's the review and it's negative.
What chutzpah, though, for that, for after the Gerstmann thing to do that this week? It's like, are you kidding me?
That is mind blowing. I mean, that's like the dumbest move that anyone could.
We're not sure if everybody hates us enough yet. What could we do?
Therefore,
some people still are giving us some credibility here. We haven't completely shot our reputation to shit. I know, sir. I mean, what the hell?
Eidos' forums are a mess right now, too, aren't they?
Really? Well, they were over the weekend. I haven't been there lately since I got trashed. I'm sorry, Sean. I interrupted your
point. No, that's fine. That was that needed to be said. That was a vital part of the conversation. It was. I mean, that's mind-blowing that happened. It's sad.
Yeah.
About the previous thing, to finish it up. Like I've said before, you know, game companies internally, you know, employ people that are evaluators, and they're there to play early builds. Sometimes they just look at design documents, you know, or they'll play late builds, whatever, and they come to these conclusions and say, this game's going to be fun, it's going to make some money. So game companies themselves very clearly believe in people's ability to evaluate unfinished product, right? But then whenever it comes to previews and you ask people, why is it that you never voice any skepticism, they say, well, because we can't, you know. I don't even believe in that. I think you do have to be careful. If it's early, it's early. But a lot of times you will get a sense. I bet if you ask any of us in this floor, say, go back to the various times that you saw any given game, it probably was very much like you thought. You know, you were probably, if your gut, even if you never wrote it or told anyone, and your gut's like, this is probably going to be like a 6 game, you know, or this is really bad. This is going to be below average. Oftentimes, they turn out exactly like you're thinking.
Sure.
And I know that for a fact. But so that aside, when we're talking about hands-on previews that are immediately preceding the launch, I think that there is dishonesty there. You know, I think a lot of times they just don't – it's dishonesty by omission. You just don't say anything bad. Or sometimes, like, you can – I mean, again, not to pick on anyone, but I'll pick on every – you know, ourselves. We do it. Everyone does it. But just – this is a convenient example I had available, and it's about Blacksite, because I was looking to see – after I write a review, I'll often compare my perspective with other critics and see if I was, like, off in my own little world or what. And so this preview says, you know – Midway showed 2 new levels of its upcoming shooter, Blacksite Area 51, which got us even more excited for its November 5 ship date. The gameplay in Blacksite is always a treat. And skipping ahead, Blacksite is shaping up to be one of the hottest shooters of the holiday season. With 2-player co-op play, online multiplayer, and a cool blend of reality with science fiction, we're looking forward to several close encounters with Blacksite when it ships on November 5. So aside from the date, the constant pimping of the date there, and the sales stuff, this is... So two hands-on levels in the way that the date goes. I believe you could play 15 minutes with any level in this game and immediately understand that this is not going to be an excellent game. At least it's not going to be one that you look forward to several close encounters with, as the quote says, or...
Very clever, though.
Or to...
Get it, close encounters.
I get it.
Yeah, that's...
I'm trying not to.
You know what? they should use that in the ad copy.
or to say that it's always a treat, you know? So, I mean, not to just pick on that, but I see a lot of things like that. And And that's why I remember when I got it and I started playing it. Remember, well, you were here, Sean and, mm-hmm. and Ryan. I kept calling you guys over. I was like, wow. Why did no one say anything about this? Fucking unbelievable.
No one warned me.
Yeah, no one. And it was like, I know the demo was out. I never played it, the one that was on Xbox Live, you know? It was like, why did no one ever say anything about this? This game sucks, dude. And it was like, there's no way a month ago that I would have been saying this.
Well, maybe this guy's opinion just differed than yours.
Hey, even the head developer thinks that game sucks.
Well, he's not head developer anymore. He was fired. it was a great week for criticizing games.
Don't get in the same problem. Was he fired or did he leave?
Yeah, we don't know this, right?
I take that back. To a mutual agreement.
I take it back. He wasn't, or we don't know.
We don't know.
But he did.
He doesn't work there anymore.
Not there anymore.
He did say the game was messed up.
Right.
And then after saying how messed up it was, he said it but it deserved an 8.
Right. Yeah, true. So he even in his complaints of the game, he's on the 7 to 9 scale with everybody else.
Which is crazy. What was we should have the actual quote with us. It was like this game, the development was fucked
development
up.
Development was, quote,
saying,
seriously fucked up.
That's not necessarily
that
saying
doesn't
the game is trash.
It could have
that's true.
In a
the
good
tone
game.
Of all of his comments didn't seem to indicate any sort of confidence or you know, or pride in the thing other than the story. And I've talked about before, and that is bold, and that was, you know, subversive move on their part.
Mm-hmm.
But that was kind of weird. And that, hey, you know, in all of this, you got to point out, and that's why it's one reason why it's so frustrating when, you know, the whole why so low thing is that, you know,
really,
you get
Sean.
This pressure all the time. You have to understand anyone ever writing a review is getting the pressure, like I said, indirectly, and they're aware of it, but it's there, right? And so the one, you're like, what's the only reason to fight it, right? Aside from just, like, ethics. I'm an ethical person. I'm going to do the right thing as I believe it to be right. Like, well, I'm also going to be doing the right thing specifically for an audience. And then when the audience itself is actually got the publisher's back, and when the audience is demanding exactly what the publisher wants,
right.
Then you start to say, well, why am I fighting so hard? Why am I causing myself trouble?
Right.
And why are we compromising the ability of, you know, our website, magazine, or whatever to provide, you know, content as soon as possible,
right,
and whatever.
We can't get it if our scores are
and
too
when
low.
The when our damn audience is mad that the shit's not meeting up the expectations of the bullshit fabricated scores on the press release on the game's website,
right.
You know?
So indeed, Sean, why so low?
Yeah.
And that was
Jeff Gerstmann's career is one of his big bullet points is that he gave Zelda an 8.8 and then the world exploded
on him.
And
there are people that are still arguing about
that. Yep, it's coming up.
Good thing he got fired. He deserved it. And it's like those people, like, God, if it weren't for the sane people that are out there, and like, God bless them, I would be out of this business. Like,
there
that
are sane
disgusting.
People.
That has those people are completely.
Yeah, I got to keep reminding myself
mental.
That too. That
right,
there
yeah,
are good people
mental.
Out there.
Right, yeah, you're right. Those people who are like good. Thank God he's gone because of that 8.8. Fuck you. Yeah. You're the reason that the guys like him are out of a job.
Do you know the other thing about it? The whole eat a dick thing in that blog. I did hear that they were all mad and they were insinuating and people on their forums or whatever were insinuating that like I was a PR hack. And that was the best bit of like Orwellian logic. It was like,
I don't get that.
Because it's Games for Windows Magazine and Games for Windows Podcast, right? Because we're affiliated with Microsoft.
Magazine, okay, so if we're Microsoft PR hacks, why wouldn't we have given Crysis a 10?
Exactly. How long did it take you to reason that? It was instantaneous.
It was in my head.
But there are
3 seconds
still on the internet, including some that run blogs that aren't able to make that.
I don't understand that.
Jump.
If right, I mean, by that logic, every game in our magazine would get a 10.
Right.
Games for Windows is great.
But instead, no, it was a move dictated. Microsoft wanted us to lowball their biggest PC game of the season.
Yeah, because that would make sense.
And lowball is in scare quotes there. So I'm
glad we eventually came to the conclusion that people on the internet are dumb.
except for everyone listening to this podcast.
So
you're
that's
all smart
one,
and we love you.
Yes.
I think people listening are going to wonder, well, what can we do about it? You know,
mm-hmm. Also, I mean, and if they're wondering why we're bitching about this, the point of this is not to point fingers or to scold CNET, because, again, honestly, we don't know what happened. There could have been a million complications to the Gerstmann thing. We don't know.
Right.
But with the scary part of it and the reason that we talk about it is because it's very close to home to us for all the reasons, Sean, that you were saying, that, like, these pressures really are real. And, you know, these barriers that we face in trying to write honest stories versus what the publishers want, what some of the audience wants, some of the fanboys want, are huge to us. Mm-hmm. And this one just really, it was scary, this Gerstmann thing, because it was so plausible.
Yeah, all it would take is, I mean, you get the right person at the top, you know, or the right people at the top, and they just change their mind about that thing, and then yep. that's all that it takes.
Oh, yeah.
You know that all the incentive's there, and it takes that one person to not be steadfast.
You've got to, I'm sure there have been a ton of times here on this floor that somebody on the other side of the building, the sales marketing side, has said out loud to other people in the room, can't we just go over and tell those fuckers in editorial to stop being so harsh? You know, they just never have actually done it.
Right.
I'm sure amongst themselves, they're like, they're killing themselves every time we publish a really mean review.
Yeah.
They got to be in there going, God damn like, it, there goes my fucking bonus.
And they're probably thinking, like, we're trying to help you guys. You guys are shooting yourselves in the foot doing that.
Right.
You know? So for the listeners that wonder what they could do, I think one, obviously, would be to don't become a raving zealot yourself when it comes to scores and demanding people's heads on pikes because they give games Zelda 8.8. You know, that's definitely one thing. Another would be to, I mean, to support the sorts of content that goes beyond, hey, we got the first look, we got the exclusive look at this, we got a new bullet point to add to the list of features of this game, but hey, here's a story that, I mean, but we have to have an audience for that. If you, you know, we talk about those kind of stories and how they still do rely on cooperation of a publisher and stuff, but they're far, far less so than any of the other crap, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think demand that. Don't just sit there hitting refresh on a website every 5 seconds hoping to get that extra bullet point about a new weapon, you know, or a new vehicle that's been announced in the game. And, I mean, you've got to help us, you know? We want to do certain things, but it's like, hey, if the audience doesn't want it, publishers don't want it, then everyone's going to end up writing them happy, happy press releases called previews.
I'll keep reading your story, Sean, because I'm paid to, so
well, we'll be paid to
four
write
of us. Just writing our own magazine
we'll
for
read
ourselves.
Each other stuff.
On this note, I do want to pimp it that Robert Ashley and I wrote, Robert wrote it, and I helped with some of the reporting story that's on Gama Sutra about, I guess if you just put our names in GamaSutra.com in your Google engine, you'll find the story. And it's basically about a lot of the things that we've been talking about, but in greater depth and with a lot of input from people that actually work in PR. At the time, you know, I tried to spread awareness for it on message boards, and people were like, well, okay, so the game industry is corrupt. This is supposed to be new because it was like absolutely missing the point, right? They clearly didn't read it. And it was like, well, it's not necessarily saying it's corrupt. It's saying there are some ways and subtleties to the, you know, to the workings of the industry that you might not be aware of. And we want to make you aware of them and to see how potentially when things could go wrong and make it corrupt.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's necessary. And also like that, outlining the part of the reader to do something else in it. And so,
yeah,
I still stand by that story. I think we did. It was an excellent, excellent piece, and I would like more people to read it.
Yeah, to me, it's like the scariest thing about like the mergers and the growing gigantic companies is just like it puts more power in the hands of fewer companies to potentially have an influence on editorial direction by withholding money. Mm-hmm. You know, this is something that's really, really changed over the last 10 years in this industry. When it was all small companies, you know, even if the ads were all related to gaming, one little company getting mad that they got a bad score could not really have this kind of influence. But now if you've got, you know, Active Blizzavision with $8 billion worth of revenue hovering over you, you know, the pressure is definitely there on the advertising side.
Yeah. So let's hit that.
Which
up.
Was my long-winded way of making that transition.
That's part, yeah. Consolidation is
happening a lot these days.
Right. And so the latest one was Vivendi Games acquired 52% of Activision over the weekend on Sunday. It was announced. And Vivendi Games is comprised of a few studios, one of which is Blizzard. So really, this is a merger of Vivendi Games and Activision, and it's being called the very clever Activision Blizzard is the name. But really, if you're wondering what that all means, you should really just substitute out the name Blizzard and put in Vivendi, because that's what it is. Activision and Vivendi merged It's just that because Vivendi has this very, very nice crown jewel called Blizzard in it, that they sort of promoted that brand name up to the top.
Right.
So it's Activision Blizzard. And I talked to Mike Morhaime, the CEO, over the weekend on Sunday. And
CEO of Blizzard,
thank you. And he basically reiterated what's up on Blizzard's website and what we're seeing everywhere else in the media, which is that it's mostly just a corporate thing that is probably not, at least they're all saying, it's not going to affect the bottom line for gamers at all. That Blizzard, for one thing, Activision didn't buy Blizzard. That's one thing that's going around. You know, there's not going to be, orcs on skateboards in the next Tony Hawk, or vice versa. Tony Hawk's not going to be skateboarding around in Azeroth. You know, these are separate. They're separate entities still. And if anybody owns anybody, it's Vivendi owns Activision, not the other way
around. People missed a better opportunity in that, because I've heard that before. That would be Shrek in World of Warcraft.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Because that would make a little more sense.
I also like all the names of the kids. I really like Actard. Blacktard was
Black
another
Division,
good one.
Activision.
I mean,
you should have been in that room when they were deciding, Jeff.
Yeah.
That's going to get old, like, we jokes, though.
Because Activision Blizzard.
10 minutes after we're done.
Yeah, they're done already. They were. I think they were not funny yesterday already. And most important, you know, this new name, Activision Blizzard, is not going to show up on any game boxes anywhere, on Blizzard products, on Vivendi products, or on Activision products. You know, it's just basically just acknowledging that name, Activision Blizzard, is just acknowledging that all the games from Activision, their whole stable of games, and all the games from Vivendi, which includes Blizzard, are now controlled by one big company.
Right.
But Blizzard itself, Blizzard Entertainment, is a publishing label. And the only games that are going to be on that publishing label with the name Blizzard on them are games that Blizzard makes.
Okay.
Right. I wouldn't care about a logo change. I mean, who gives a crap?
Right.
But I would be more concerned if there were definite repercussions for, like, how Blizzard operates that comes out of this. And I don't think there are, right?
But there aren't.
As far as you know, yeah.
Right. I mean, they're saying it's completely business as usual for them.
So,
the only thing that happened here for Blizzard is that they got their name elevated to a higher level. That's the only reason that Blizzard is even coming up in the story. Which is just Vivendi just acknowledged, hey, this is the most high profile name and the name with the best reputation, and so they're able to use this event as a way of rebranding the whole thing. So, there you go. Cool. Am I boring you to death?
No.
No?
Okay. No.
All right. Anyway, that's it. And just related to the other story, the only reason I even think we could take it as bad news is just, yeah, you know, the more everybody merges and becomes one giant Activision EA UBIDOS.com, the less, you know, it just worries me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The last big one was, what, EA BioWare? That was just a couple weeks ago. But caused a lot of worry, too, so who knows?
Right.
Consolidation time.
Mm-hmm.
That's happening everything with media that covers games, too, though, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And they're all owned by three companies.
Yeah, you know? Who the hell even owns us?
At this point,
McDonald's?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I agree.
I'm so beat up today.
How are we doing on time there?
We got 10 minutes.
We haven't even talked about games that we love this week.
Well, I was going to say, yeah,
this was the rant
division. I was attempting to find some way to transition and talk about Unreal Tournament 3 and Soldier of Fortune.
Is this going to be happy talk, though?
Not really. I mean,
do we need happy talk?
No. This is going to be the all hate podcast.
Are you
podcast?
Now my editor-in-chief telling me I can only say good things about
Sean,
games
please say something positive about our games, about the games we cover, so that the advertisers will like us.
The bad about UT3 isn't necessarily the game's doing. It's probably connected to it, but is just that it doesn't... Nothing is indicating to me that it's doing very well, that it's selling well.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing, my only judge for that is online discussion, but more importantly, number of active servers. So hey, a lot of people could be playing offline with bots. I mean, that they've always said that a lot of, that that's how a lot of people play it.
Some people prefer it that
way. Some people prefer it that way. Others like myself don't. And so, but I know that for online right now, from I facts from a very few different sources, and one of them is, you know, basically GameSpy's server stuff information. And as of like sometime yesterday at peak, it sounds like that while 385 people were playing Flat Out 2, which is the racing game, sort of hillbilly racing game, there were 282 people playing Unreal Tournament 3.
Oh, God.
However, this morning when I looked on, when you look at GameTracker.com, which is actually a really interesting site, you can look at every server online for every major multiplayer PC game at any given moment and see how many people are playing. When I looked before we taped, I sent you the link, Jeff. It looked like there were about 40 people playing online Unreal Tournament 3. And when you can compare that to Soldier of Fortune Payback, actually had hundreds of people playing. So it actually had quite a few more people playing. Many 40? Of them in Germany. Yes, 40 people.
Okay, so everybody's at school and work, though, during the day. So
this is global, too, mind you. So this is servers in Australia, UK, Germany, all these other like crucial hubs. That is, for
wait, 40 people worldwide?
That is unbelievable.
We're playing Unreal Tournament. Yeah, that means there are like more people listening to this podcast.
By like two.
By like three or four.
We need the Price is Right loser music there.
And it was really sad to look at a few things on there. Like when I looked at Fortress Forever, it's just the mod that just came out. It's basically a more classic take on Team Fortress than, you know, Team Fortress 2. And there were about like eight people playing that. And there were two occupied servers. Mm. And that's really sad considering that it took like at least 2 years to make that. Insurgency is another big mod that came out. And there weren't very many people playing that. Meanwhile, Team Fortress 2, Call of Duty 4 are absolutely packed.
Yeah.
All this, the usual data feed source and Counter-Strike source. But COD 4 and Team Fortress 2 are loaded. Page after page of populated servers.
Right. And we knew that would have a ripple effect on all these other games, but
right.
Not 40 and those
are right.
People.
And those are right. Those are right.
Crisis Multiplayer was in the exact same position. It was actually, it looked like it was like fewer people were playing than Unreal Tournament 3.
Right. Of course, that's billed much more as a single-player game anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
Unreal that's Tournament different. 3, though, I mean, this is... That's bad.
Yeah. And I... The thing is I can, like, sympathize with it because been, you know, playing it, the game, I just don't like the game. I always... I can play for about 10 to 15 minutes, and then I always want to just turn it off. And I just don't... It's not very entertaining to me. I don't like it. There's, despite, I really want to. I mean, you get in and sometimes certain things look so great. You know, I was playing Vehicle CTF in this map called Sandstorm, and with all the tentacled Necros vehicles flying around and, you know, actual sandstorms rip through it, and they've got headlights that are like, you know, kind of like blazing through there, and so much stuff is going on. You're like, God, this is fantastic. If you know, like Battlefield 2 even looked anything like this, God, I would have been like going crazy. Mm-hmm. And then you just play it and you're like, this game is just a spaz fest, you know. It's just nonsense.
So really, you could take your comments, you could reverse them, and then you could actually have that exact review text you were quoting earlier. You could say, right. This game is a complete spaz fest. However, man, it looks great.
It does look very, very nice. That's how I'd say it. Yeah, that's kind of a bummer. But it's like, I think the demo was out there, and that was the same impression I got from the demo. You know, it's like I wouldn't wanted to buy it based on the demo. And I don't know if people are concerned about if the problem is that they're worried about how much hardware it takes to run it.
Yeah.
But again, though, Unreal Engine 3 is very scalable. You can strip that game down to nothing but just like basically untextured polys and play. And a lot of people do play those Unreal games that way anyway because they want the performance over the appearance.
Right.
So I don't know how I feel about that excuse. I don't think that the technology is as much of an impediment, you know, an entry barrier as you can make it out to be, as it would be with clearly is with Crysis, you know. But yeah, I did talk a little bit about that game, you know, last time we recorded, so I don't need to say that much more other than that it's just very, I don't know, it's very unsatisfying for me to play. But Soldier of Fortune Payback is interesting because there are more people playing in Europe online than they are playing. That game, I just say something about it. It's like you kind of go in expecting not so much because it's labeled a value game, right? It's labeled a budget game. And then, you know, that was making me think about some other stuff too. I was like, hey, I'm looking around at reviews for this and everyone's being really critical of this. This is getting low scores, well below fives, even for sites that their average is a 7 or an 8, you know? And, and I was kind of wondering, I was like, hey, is labeling it a budget game kind of the publisher's way of saying like, it's okay, we understand. You can write a real review with this one.
I think in a lot of cases, you know, it's their way of saying, please don't review this.
It is that too. You often won't get the
they're
review
saying,
code.
Yeah, they're saying, don't. This isn't for you guys.
So I don't want to get the order of operations mixed up here and say that like, oh, well, people are extra harsh on budget games because, of course, they're often budget games because
right.
they suck, you know. But in cases like I found that Area 51 and Soldier of Fortune, if you take away two crucial elements, you take away the attempts to work the narrative into Area 51 and you take out the gratuitous gore, which you actually can do with an option in Soldier of Fortune, they're basically the same game. They're the same, just completely mediocre, templated game. And I was like, hey, why? But then Area 51's got all the 7s and 6.5s and stuff, and this is the one on the same side that's getting lower. And I kind of wondered about that. I was
well,
like,
doesn't
hey,
Area 51 have a little bit more, I could be wrong, but a little bit more of a interesting story?
That's what I was saying. The story is kind of there. I don't think that the story, I think it's interesting to look at the fact that someone attempted to make a AAA mass market game mm-hmm. with a story as subversive as this.
Right.
I'm not saying I think that the story is especially successful.
Right.
But it's an interesting
yeah,
story.
They tried.
Right. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's not enough to, when you're done playing the game, while you think about the story, it's not enough to say, okay, this game sucked, but the story was good. It's you should play it for the story.
Right.
You just shouldn't play it. No. And Soldier of Fortune, like I said, I mean, it very much is the same game where, you know, you enemies pop up from scripted locations, which is normal, but they always run to the same points. And if you die, they'll do it again and again. And then when you do anything unpredictable, they're never able to react to it. So say, you know, they're going to jump out of a window and run over to this part in the street. If you continue to walk past them, they're going to just stay there in the street because that's the end of the line. That they can go no further than that. Mm-hmm. But so Soldier of Fortune will do a few, it'll do a few things where it's kind of like, hey, let's put the equivalent of a boss in here. But this is supposed to be a very realistic game. You know, it's a real world game. You're in Afghanistan, you're in various parts of the Middle East, you go throughout Southeast Asia. And you'll have, inexplicably though, you'll have, okay, this is like the chief terrorist. And that, in their world, means that he's basically got 8 to 10 times the hit points as the other guys. And the other guys, their heads explode in a gory mess when you hit him with one bullet. And suddenly, here's this guy that, you know, it's not, he doesn't have a helmet on. He's not wearing, you know, a flak jacket or anything.
Yeah, but he's a boss.
But you got to shoot this guy. Yeah, you got to shoot this dude forever.
Why don't you get that?
And then both of them, too, they both love the exploding barrels. It's like, that's always the sign where, I mean, like, in one mission, you're up in these mountains and there's all these, you know, plank walkways and stuff. But up there, there's just barrels and dudes hiding behind them. So it's like they erected these elaborate, you know, rope bridges and all this stuff just so that they could then bring the barrels up there with them and then chill behind
with
those
fuel.
Boys.
It is very convenient of all those bad guys in all those games.
To bring those.
To have flammable
and
barrels
so
everywhere.
So it's like, I point on that because that's now like just, that's just the token sign of, okay, you're just making this game by, you got this book, you got like how to make an FPS for dummies or whatever,
yeah.
you know, and there's like the chapter on like, players love to feel in control, they're empowered in their environment by causing explosions and other stuff. So don't be afraid to throw, you know, combustible barrels wherever you want. So then you see the guy up on the top of the mountain and he's just up there alone with the barrel. So they dropped that. They brought a helicopter in and dropped that thing off for him.
One exploding barrel.
Why don't you hide behind this?
You just sit in there. And then, of course, like if you're ever like somewhere and you're not by a barrel, your key thing should be to run toward one, you know. And some of it gets ridiculous like that. But the thing about this game is that it bills itself as I mean, you know, one of the key, you know, box pullouts and one of the things that they've you know, brought a great deal of attention to in the promotional materials and their websites and stuff is how gory it is, right? I mean, like in my review, I compared it to, you know, human body is in this game what trees are to Crysis, where you hit someone at the point of impact, the limb comes off, gore squirts out, they continue to bleed. If you take off a foot, they'll just drag themselves around, and they'll still fight, and so you're then encouraged to go up and deliver the coup de grace and shoot their face off and mangle them. If there's bodies pile up, you throw a grenade in them, and the chunks and gore just paint the environment, and they go everywhere.
Awesome. But,
I mean, that's always been a staple of the series, you know. I mean, this has always been the thing about Soldier of Fortune. But the thing is the timing now, and I was thinking about that, is that now, I mean, since it's all anti-terrorist, and you're going to all these places that we understand, like, oh, this is very much like Kandahar or something, you know. It's like, I'm reacting differently to it, you know. Uh-huh. I mean, you make these games like, sorry, I'm getting the wrap-up thing, so I got to wrap this shit up. But, yeah, fuck it, we're done. I don't know. I always want to talk about games, man. Fuck me for wanting to talk about games. Sorry.
Yeah, fuck you for talking about games, Sean. Don't you know what this is?
Yeah.
Jeez. Now we're just out of time this week. We'll be back. Hold that thought. Yeah?
Thoughts? Nothing.
Nothing? Oh. Are we done?
We're done.
Yeah, we got time.
That was good. I wanted to add one just quick, very personal note, which is that... I just wanted to thank everybody. I've gotten like hundreds, literally hundreds of messages about my cat that passed away. I had blogged about it a week ago, and I got tons of great comments. I just wanted to thank everybody for taking the time to do that. That meant a lot. So, thank you.
Fuck it.
Oh, I hate that on a sad note. Let's end on
some
other
note. Good note. I forgot we had a contest. Well, I also wanted to give Granny credit for producing and making the beat for the intro. As always, is awesome. And we have got a contest. You can win both Company Heroes and Company Heroes Opposing Fronts together. The rules are basically what you need to do is listen to last week's podcast, and we talked about bad gamers holiday buying guides. And you write your own entry for a product. You just pick something and you do a write up for it. And the rules are on our forums, on the 1UP forums, and there's a thread stickied at the top, and it will say GFW Radio Win Company Heroes. Go look at the rules there and put your entry in there. And then next week, we will all announce the winners and we'll send those off right away.
Sweet.
And we will be back with a longer podcast next week, I promise. And it just crossed my mind, did Ryan say anything at all this podcast?
I said a couple things.
You did?
There he goes.
Yeah. I'm tired today. I'll have more. We're recording Legendary Thread later. I'll have a lot to say on that.
Right. Okay. Ryan Scott fans, listen to Legendary Thread this week.
And, amen.
So nobody will be listening to Legendary Thread this week.
Sure they will, because you're on it, Ryan. Okay, we got to go. We're out.
This 1UP podcast is brought to you by the Laptop Experts, makers of the Toshiba Satellite X205, a laptop with enough power to destroy a small planet. Visit www.toshiba.com/expert.